Welcome to Breaking Free Podcast, your recovery, your way. I'm Tiffany.
And I'm Liv. You're in the right place if you want to explore what it means to be in recovery, to challenge the things that keep us small, and to learn how to thrive independently.
Together we are breaking free. Just a quick reminder that while I'm a nurse and a coach, and Liv is a coach, recovery advocate, and a writer, we are not doctors. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you need to, please, please see a doctor.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services.
Unity Recovery, an inclusive recovery community organization serving all of Philadelphia, is proud to support the Breaking Free podcast. Recovery is possible. Find your path to break free.
Hi, today we are talking about sugar addiction. Mm. Oh, so Tiffany, this is both our areas of expertise, but you deal more with this on a daily basis than I do. And I would love to hear your point of view. What do you think about sugar addiction? Is it a thing?
Is sugar addiction a thing?
Is it a thing?
Well, I think that there's a lot of diet culture messaging out there that tells us that we're sugar addicts and that sugar's bad, and that if we have a disordered eating pattern around sugar, or if we eat, an arbitrary amount, but if we eat sugar in a way that feels out of control, then there's something wrong with us. So yeah. We must be sugar addicts.
And that it's something that I often see among people in recovery, that they are very quick to label this out of control eating around sugary foods, and to say, oh my god, I suffer. In the same way as relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Oh my god, I'm a sex and love addict. Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, I'm a sugar addict, I'm a food addict. And you know, I think for people in recovery, there's several reasons for it. One is that we are told in the recovery community that, you know, once an addict, always an addict. You're just addicted to everything. You have an addicted personality. There's something wrong with your wiring that makes you an addict. And also because a lot of times when we get sober or seek recovery and start to, you know, especially in pathways of abstinence, when we start to seek that out, then we're put into a state of, you know, basically having to find other ways of coping, right?
Yeah.
And our brain chemistry and our hormones are all out of whack. And so a lot of times our guts, you know, are all out of whack too, because we've just, you know, a lot of times we've just been relying primarily on alcohol instead of food.
Yeah.
And
a combination of pickling and an increase of sugar.
Yeah.
I say to my dentist, I'm sure my teeth were healthier when I used to pick on my mouth every day.
What did the dentist say about that?
I'm not sure. Maybe you're dealing with years of abuse. I don't know. Mm. So I think it's important to address the neurochemical aspects of this. Tell me more about dopamine tone.
Yeah. So in terms of actual sugar addiction or food addiction, the jury is really still out. And so what we're finding, so there's a food addiction scale that Yale put out, maybe it was like 2007, something like that. And that's part of where the language is coming out, right? And diet culture is grabbed onto, oh, there is, you know, food addiction is real. But the jury's still out. Science is not yet caught up. And we don't really know whether, because the thing is, it does affect your chemistry, right? And it affects your hormones, but it doesn't affect your brain in the same way that other substances do. And people say, well, it lights up the same pathways as cocaine, therefore it must be addictive, right? Well, unfortunately, a lot of studies that are done on rats or, you know, other animals that have been food restricted, so they're hungry, or they've been specifically restricted when it comes to sugar. And what we know also about brain chemistry is that we actually upregulate so that our reward centers around sugar actually increase when we restrict it.
Yeah.
So if you've got a rat that hasn't had any for a long time, their desire for it is actually going to increase, and the rewards that they get are actually higher or greater than they would have if they'd just eaten sugar all along.
Interesting.
So unfortunately, most of those studies do not control for restriction. Mm-hmm. And with our diet culture the way it is today, I would say the majority of women and a lot of men either have been on restrictive diets or have been restricting in the sense of, that's bad, I shouldn't eat it.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're telling yourself every night that ice cream's bad and I shouldn't eat it, you're restricting on some level. You're kind of having this like fight with yourself around it and trying not to eat it. And that's going to actually have... cause you to have an increased desire. And then if you do restrict it and you don't eat it for a period of time, it's going to feel really great when you do eat it in terms of your reward centers.
And then reinforce that desire, right? As high reward.
Yeah. And then if I eat a lot of it, then I must be an addict, right?
Yeah, of course.
So it's really complicated. So there's actually a physiological reason that we enjoy it more if we've restricted.
Yeah.
If you think about, you know, foods that you haven't had, like Thanksgiving, I don't know, you know, for you, Liv, what Thanksgiving really meant or how it looked in your life.
It was non-existent.
Yeah, because you're in England, right?
Yeah.
But here in America, for a lot of people, it's a big thing. We have a certain set of foods that we have, and it's like, oh, I haven't had those in so long. And, you know, fall's starting to come up. People are, oh, pumpkin lattes, whatever it is, right? If you haven't had it in a long time, it's going to be that much more pleasurable, right? So in terms of the dopamine, though, your question there, it's really interesting because we have two, and I'm going to try to simplify this as much as possible. When we're talking about neurochemistry.
And not because we think our audience doesn't understand, but because we want to get this into 30 minutes.
Yeah, we have a limited amount of time. And, you know, I am a nurse, but I also have, you know, I have a science background, but I have a limited scope there too.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when it comes to neurochemistry, it's complicated, and dopamine, there's a couple of different ways we get dopamine. So we have this kind of low-lying dopamine tone where you get a steady stream of dopamine.
Yeah.
And then we have these bursts of dopamine.
Yeah.
And so there's different, you know, there's like D2 receptors, and if you want to get into the science, it's really fascinating but complex. So when you're getting the bursts of dopamine, you're not really getting the steady stream.
Yeah.
So we've been relying on bursts of dopamine, or a lot of times I think probably for people who are struggling with addiction in the first place, you know, maybe already your dopamine is off, right? Exactly. So, you know, so sugar does not affect our brain the same way that cocaine does, but it does light up the pleasure pathways, and it does increase, you know, those bursts of dopamine. And so it makes sense that we'd want more dopamine.
Yeah, because we feel like shit when we're in recovery, in early recovery. Although, you know, 7 years later, I occasionally...
waxes and wanes, right? But there's a reason that we struggled in the first place. You know, potentially we didn't have enough dopamine, and then the way that we tend to use increases that problem, right? And kind of increases that dependence on these bursts of dopamine. So, so it's much more complicated, and it is something that we can do something about, but in the meantime, knowing that, it's helpful to know, it's not... that I need to beat myself up.
Yeah, because I think people in recovery just lean towards, because we can be so focused on what's defective about us, we can automatically assume that this is greed, or what's the seven deadly sin? Gluttony. Right? Mm-hmm. When actually, if we look a little bit deeper, this is our body telling us something that it needs.
Yeah, and it's also, it's telling us that it's doing its best to cope with what it has, right?
And I want to clarify that. I'm not saying the body needs sugar. I'm saying that actually, in its basic form, it's a carbohydrate. So your body is telling you that it's tired and it needs energy.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, that can be one of the things that it's telling you. It can also be a clue that, you know, my dopamine is low and maybe I need other things to increase my dopamine. Or, maybe I'm exhausted and I actually need some sleep, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to go a little bit more into this toward the end. We'll talk about what we can do instead. But this isn't a reason to feel like you're a piece of shit, pardon my French, but, you know, it's not. It is a reason to recognize that our bodies are struggling and that we're human beings and that there are biological processes happening that are beyond our control. That doesn't mean automatically that you're a food addict. Or sugar addict.
Yeah. And in dealing with this, you don't necessarily want to apply the same, you know, if you're in an abstinence-based program, I don't believe, you know, I mean, some proponents of a 12-step program believe that you could apply this to anything in your life, but you can't restrict food.
Yeah. So it's interesting because one of the reasons that I am in the camp more so of that sugar addiction isn't a clear thing, partially because the science isn't fully there yet, but also because it is so clouded by whether restriction plays into it and all of the other pieces. But also because I don't necessarily think that it is something that we can look at the same as abstinence is the way, right, to change that, or even a really helpful pathway necessarily. Now, I'm not speaking for all people, but for me personally, I did think that I was a sugar addict. And what I found is through intuitive eating and by letting go of restriction and by focusing instead on other, you know, holistic ways of caring for myself, that I was able to find a more balanced relationship with food than I had previously when I tried to just cut sugar out entirely or cut out certain foods. And why it's problematic is, as I mentioned before, when we cut it out entirely, we actually develop this increased desire for it.
Yeah.
Both because of the forbidden fruit type effect, but also you actually get more, you know, primed in terms of your reward centers, as I mentioned. So when you eat it, you actually get more dopamine from it. You actually feel, right, if you restrict it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work the same as abstinence-based recovery from other addictions or from, you know, addiction from substance use or alcohol use disorder. And because, as Liv mentioned, you know, you can't avoid food, right? Like, yeah. Food is part of our life. And so I believe that by telling ourselves, you know, I'm just an addict all across the board and trying to restrict sugar, we're actually setting ourselves up for failure and we're setting ourselves up for more blame and shame and harm in terms of our mental health. Yeah. And it actually increases propensities for disordered eating and eating disorders. And so when we as a culture, as a whole, are, oh, I just have to quit sugar, I'm just a sugar addict, we're actually contributing potentially to that problem for ourselves, but also for other people. So it's harmful in terms of increasing diet culture and increasing kind of like feeling like there's something wrong with us.
Yeah. And I think using the word addict too, right? I mean, and I've seen people use the word sugar junkie. And, you know, as we've talked about in other episodes, we know that the word addict and junkie are pejorative. They are stigmatizing.
They are stigmatizing.
It's not helpful. And it's just shaming.
It's shaming. And I feel like it's also sort of like dismissive or minimizing the seriousness of substance use disorder and alcohol use disorder. And, you know, if it turns out that a certain subset of people do have, you know, if the research finally comes through that it's not about, you know, that if we control for restriction and all of that, and still there's this smaller subset of people that actually have a true addiction.
Yeah.
Because you also have to control for like binge eating disorder, because binge eating disorder and food addiction are not the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and a bunch of other other issues that are going on potentially. Then, you know, really we're harming those people who really are struggling just by throwing those terms around.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually really, really not helpful in terms of the kind of collective mental health of and food health of our community.
I agree. And I remember I went to an OA meeting, and I have friends who are in Gracie Anonymous. Have you heard of Gracie? Which, and for those of you that don't know, this was the original program of Overeaters Anonymous. And I mean, to me, I'll come to that in a second before our break, but in the meantime, I wanted to think about when I went to OA and I was told that I would need to make an amends for my eating behavior. I mean, that just seems crazy to me. And I think if you're not careful as a person in 12-step, you can very quickly end up spreading yourself so thinly among so many different types of fellowships for things that are actually not defective about you. You know, I would argue that, you know, craving love and attention is actually, you know, a human need.
Yeah.
And the same with food. You know, if your food is, your relationship with food is disordered, look deeper. You know, it's an invitation. These are invitations, I think, rather than using them as tools to manipulate our relationship with food or to have to apologize and make amends for our behavior. Gracie Anonymous, I would argue, is you know, and this is pretty strong, but I would say it's potentially an addiction in itself, you know, having to call your food into a sponsor every day and weigh your food out and force yourself to eat such a huge quantity of vegetables when you're not hungry, it seems kind of crazy to me.
Yeah.
And have absolutely no carbohydrates, only starches, and very minimal starches at that is...
It's
very unhelpful.
Yeah, so I've actually attended some OA meetings, and I had, you know, people that I was close to that went to OA meetings, and I found that it wasn't realistic for my life, and that it did feel too restrictive. You know, I didn't want the idea that I'd have to say that I had like relapsed if I decided to have a piece of cake at a wedding. You know, like that just felt.
It's punitive.
Yeah. So there's actually an article that I'll put in the show notes. It's called For the Intuitive Eating Haters, This Post Is For You.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. And she talks a little bit about this perspective of, you know, why it's harmful, and talks also about really, you know, whether you're going to eat all the things. And anyway, it's a fascinating article. I love it. So I'll put it in the show notes as well. But for now, we have to take a little break to hear from our wonderful sponsors, and we'll be right back.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services. As the largest and most diversely programmed non-clinical recovery support center in the United States, we've been proudly breaking barriers and forging new pathways for years to ensure everyone has a home in recovery. From peer mentoring to recovery CrossFit, from trauma-informed yoga to mindfulness training, the Alana Club of Portland has a recovery pathway that's right for you.
Here at Unity Recovery, we believe recovery should be the expectation, not the exception. Whether you find support with mutual aid, harm reduction, medication, or yoga, your recovery is beautiful and worth celebrating. Learn more and become part of the recovery movement at unityrecovery.org.
And we're back.
All right, so let's talk about the reasons for sugar cravings.
I love this topic.
Tell me all the things.
So many reasons. So some of the reasons are simply stress. So if you think about, you know, especially when you're new in recovery or, you know, just about everybody I've talked to who struggles with disordered eating, all of my clients who've come to me have been under a tremendous amount of stress. And whether that is because of, you know, physiological things going on with their body, or whether that is because of, you know, their stressful work environments, whatever it is, you know, being new in recovery, all of those things, having kind of a chronic state. So, you know, cortisol by itself isn't bad. And actually, when you first have cortisol spike, your appetite is actually suppressed. But then when it kind of wears off, you get hungry. So if you think about if you have a job interview, right, you know, oftentimes before a job interview, or maybe you have to speak publicly, you don't feel hungry at all.
No.
But then after, you're like ravenous, right?
Yeah.
But being in a chronic state of fight or flight over time, having an increased level of cortisol or having cortisol spikes at weird times of the day will cause you to have an increased desire for food. And then just being exhausted, right? Fatigue. If you think about when you're really hungry, you just can't quite get enough to eat. Especially a lot of women that I know are nighttime eaters. So they push themselves all day long and they've done fine. But then in the evening time, they want to try to stay up, you know, watch one more show or finally have some downtime, whatever it is. And they just can't get enough food. So they sit, you know, sit and eat and watch TV.
And also, what about people in recovery who have had trauma in the past? They also suffer with HPA axis dysfunction. So in real words, Tiffany, what does that mean?
Yeah, so for people who have had trauma, a lot of times, you know, you have been in that chronic state or fight or flight. So that's all, you know, your cortisol is all over the place, but also you're looking for a way to soothe, right?
Yeah.
And to kind of disconnect from your body. And so that's one way to do it, is using substances, increasing your dopamine, you know, all of those things. And so, you know, in my circles, we call that self-soothing or self-silencing. So, you know, maybe it's something that you haven't felt that you can speak of, or maybe you're still experiencing that trauma.
I had this in early recovery. I would go to a meeting And I should disclose, for those of you that have not listened to any episodes where I've shared this, I do have complex PTSD. Mm-hmm. And that means my nervous system is dysregulated, mm-hmm. and especially around cortisol, I often feel exhausted. Particularly after meetings, I would have this overwhelming desire to soothe myself with food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, I have really worked at destigmatizing this, or taking the shame and the judgment out of this concept or this pattern that people have. And how I look at it now is reestablishing safety.
Yeah. And how do you do that?
Lots of ways. So those are some of the reasons, but also having vitamin and mineral deficiencies. So a lot of times people who crave chocolate actually have a magnesium deficiency. And so I used to eat chocolate like every night, and I do enjoy chocolate. But since I started taking a magnesium supplement that is the right kind and the right dose for me, my doctor helped me to discover which is right for me, I hardly ever crave chocolate. It's really interesting. So I, occasionally eat it, but like I've had the same chocolate in my fridge for weeks, and I've eaten like a bite here, a bite there, and that's not how it would have been at all for me in the past. And it's not because, I mean, I definitely had the restriction issue, but once I got past that, I still wanted chocolate a lot. Now, I hardly ever want it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So there's definitely a lot of reasons for that. And then, of course, there's like what's going on with your gut bacteria. So, if you have kind of an imbalance, certain types of bacteria are actually going to cause you to crave sugar. So, that happens. It's a real thing also.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as I mentioned, there's the forbidden fruit. So, I can't have this. If you think about, I was actually telling Liv right before this, I have a gluten intolerance. I have an autoimmune condition. When I eat gluten, it makes my body hurt. And so I don't eat it. But I have been craving it lately. And so I actually dreamt about during eating cake the other day. Unfortunately, we're in Portland. There's lots of gluten-free, places where I can get cake. Not quite the same, right?
Yeah.
And so I think since I've been craving it more, or kind of having that like forbidden fruit thing, it makes me eat other things, like maybe I'll eat more cookies than I would have because I really want this piece of cake that I can't have, right? I can have it. I choose not to because I don't want to hurt. So it's not worth it for me anymore. But it's, this happens for me at different times of the year, like at Christmas, because there's certain kinds of cookies that, I miss from my childhood, or like at Easter time.
Yeah.
There's certain candies that I just get this increased desire. So yeah. That forbidden fruit piece. And then there's also like an inner rebel. If you tell yourself you can't have it, right, that's going to be like, F you, I'm going to have whatever I want. And then we tend to eat more than we would have, right, if we just let ourselves enjoy it, because we're having that like, I need to hold on to this.
Yeah. So what are the solutions? Do we eat all of the sugar? Is this, I guess this has become my question that's out there at the minute. Is it that binary? Is it
a yes
or, yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the answer?
Yeah, I think that keeping it binary, yes or no, does contribute to that disordered, eating behavior, or that pattern of feeling like we have to binge on it, right? Because we're still judging it as good or bad. And so for me, I think really making it emotionally neutral and much more about how does my body respond to this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've mentioned this before. Cane sugar gives me a headache. As I've mentioned also in this episode, that if I'm craving a piece of cake, I will have, a piece of cake or cupcake from Gem or Kira's, one of the other, bake shops in Portland. And it gives me a headache, right? So it's not really worth it for me when I'm able to tune into my body and figure out like, oh, this doesn't feel good to me.
Yeah.
So I would say it's not yes or no. It's how did your body respond?
Yeah.
And also, by giving yourself permission to have it, you may see a period where you eat everything that you haven't been letting yourself have, or you eat it. It's almost like your body's trying to confirm, like, am I really going to be allowed to do this?
Because the power of choice is something we've not been given to ourselves. It's Absolutely. A really foreign concept, because diets tell us, condition us to believe not to listen to our hunger.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times we have, especially for women, we've had our mothers, you know, kind of on our shoulder telling us like, that's bad, you shouldn't have that. Right. And so we might have that inner rebel of, you know, well, mom, I'm going to eat whatever I want. Right. Yeah. And so you might find yourself having this kind of, pattern for where for a while you eat it in a way that's like, oh my gosh, right? This feels like a lot. Yeah. And it makes me nervous. It's scary. Yeah.
So we should release ourselves from that judgment.
Yeah. So I think, you know, telling ourselves like I can never eat sugar actually increases the problem over time. You know, short term it might be helpful, but long term I think it's really harmful. And again, it increases the reward for sugar. I'm going to shift out of the should I eat it or shouldn't I for a moment. And really the way I look at it is this a blame or a responsibility issue? And so saying I'm just a sugar addict or I have no willpower or I'm just an emotional overeater, these are ways that we blame ourselves.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we can go on about the food industry and, right, that's still blame. Although I think, you know, it's important to recognize that there's truth in the foods being really modified and sugar is actually being put in everything now and, you know, whatever. But but again, those are blaming. So if you look at, Brené Brown has a great video on blame. You should, you know, check it out if you haven't had a chance. I really love it. But if we switch from blaming to taking responsibility and holding accountable, right? So moving toward let's hold the food industry accountable and also let's take responsibility for what's going on. And I don't mean by saying I can never eat sugar. I mean instead by really getting in tune with your body and figuring out what's actually going on. Am I exhausted? Okay, well, are you staying up until 3 a.m?
Yeah.
You know, are you looking at screens right up until you go to bed and not sleeping well? Are you not eating all day long and then you're ravenous, right? Are you, you know, is your cortisol through the roof? Like, do you need to do something about your stress level?
Yeah.
Do you have underlying trauma that's not resolved? So then looking at, hey, maybe actually therapy would be good, or maybe getting into, you know, doing, we just had an interview with Jamie Marich, doing her process. Anyway, you know, so there's so many other things we can do, right? So by releasing judgment and getting curious and taking responsibility, we can really start to care for ourselves on a deeper level. You know, if your gut's all out of whack, you know, there's lots of supplements and things you can do. You can just drink bone broth every day that you've made yourself, right? There's a million things that we can do that are addressing the underlying problems that are causing us to have this increased desire for sugar that isn't about controlling sugar.
Yeah. So what would you say to somebody that is in early recovery and has been told to go on a sugar-free diet or like a 28-day kickstart? What would you tell them?
I would tell them to look at what are they really desiring? So are they desiring to have more energy? Are they desiring to feel better? Are they just afraid that there's something wrong with them because of, you know, the wanting to eat candy every day, whatever it is?
Yeah.
And then what do you desire, right? So if you are like, oh, I'm just an emotional overeater, there's something wrong with me, controlling food for 28 days isn't going to change your relationship with your emotions, and it's not going to change your relationship with food, right?
No.
You might feel better for those 28 days physically, except for the part where you're making yourself a little crazy because you can't eat anything, right? And you're friggin' hungry. So, you know, if you're wanting to address emotional eating, learning how to honor your emotions in other ways besides food, not controlling the food, is the solution.
And also, I think it's important to acknowledge that people in early recovery strive after the bodies, like they do put on weight a lot of the time. They do put on weight because if you think about it, we've not been eating well. We've been using alcohol, drugs,
cocaine.
And it kind of, you know, if you're to compare it, it's kind of like a 50-year-old woman wanting her 20-year-old body. It's just it's not going to happen. Like, our metabolism changes. We've probably caused some damage to our metabolism in being so restrictive. So, you know, that there's some work to do around body image and about acknowledging that actually in caring for ourselves by eating food, you know, it's going to take time for that to bed in, that, you know, food is not something to be restricted in a punishing sense, because we consider it to be putting weight on and not what we want for our bodies. Mm-hmm. Like you said, food isn't, we should try and make it emotionally neutral. Mm-hmm. You know, food is nourishing.
Yeah. So that's a good point. So one study that they did a long, long time ago, and I've cited this study before, it was in the 40s, and they took young men and they restricted them so that they could see the best way to feed them again after starvation, right? And these men actually started to think that their bodies, they're emaciated, you know, very small, skinny, you know, kind of bony, you know, they're just skin and bones, that their bodies were normal and that people who are larger than them were fat or overweight. Mm-hmm. So people who were, you know, in really average size bodies. And so it gave them kind of this body dysmorphia. And so that's one thing to kind of keep in mind is that as you come into recovery, if you haven't been getting the nourishment, like you said, and if your body has been smaller, that's your brain starts to think that that's the norm.
Yeah.
And so when you do put on weight because you are now properly nourished, it's going to be hard at first for your brain to see that as normal or healthy for mm-hmm. you. And then, of course, our diet culture tells us that smaller is better. And I'm not sure why we have this idea that we should go back, like you said, like pre-baby body or pre-sober body. Like, I don't want to go back to who I was before I got sober, you know, or before I became, you know, started to piece together recovery, right?
Because it's realistic that you will put on weight in recovery.
Yeah, well,
you know, you're not going to fit in kids' clothes anymore, right? Yeah.
And I just want to be well. I want to feel good, and so that's what my focus is my health, and not what I ate today. And so that's the other thing I would say for someone new in recovery is really focus on actually eating regularly throughout the day, paying attention to, when am I actually hungry, like getting more in tune with your body, mm-hmm. and then starting to address the underlying issues that are causing you to feel kind of so out of whack and so exhausted and caring for yourself in that way.
Yeah. And I think too, sometimes in certain mutual aid programs, there is an encouragement to, I think there's this old belief in 12-step programs, and actually one of the literature, Living Sober, encourages people to eat sugar. Mm. You know, I've had sponsors tell me to carry around a bag of candy.
Yeah, because in the moment it helps you cope, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't really help your teeth or your gut health or your brain blood chemistry sugar. Or any of that. Yeah. So, you know, if you, I wouldn't say try to control sugar, but I would say let's focus on developing healthy coping strategies other than food.
Yeah.
And then, you know, really letting go of judgment around food.
And sleep, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, go sleep and then eat some food.
Because we don't focus on sleep. No. I think sometimes there's this, you know, I was listening to Dawn's Mama Dawn's podcast on 10 things she would say. Yeah, let's give a bell.
Yeah, so She Recovers has a podcast and Mama Dawn came on.
10 things she would say to women in 12-step programs. And the suggestion that you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, mm-hmm. it's ludicrous. You know, especially women with children and with commitments who have a job. It's completely unrealistic. And I totally relate to this. I was told to do 90 and 90, and then I was told to do another 90 and 90. And I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And actually, it made my cravings for carbohydrates and my binging behavior worse mm-hmm. because I was out twice a day at meetings. I was exhausted.
Yeah. I did actually do 90 and 90. And in some ways, I was grateful for the experience because at that point, I had a really hard time, like, just differentiating, like, willingness and feeling willing and these things. But I did have a young child. Fortunately, you know, I was only working part-time, so I did have, like, physically had the time. And, you know, I was going to be awake anyway because I had a young child. But it was really hard for me, and I think that it wasn't recognized that, like, if I didn't go to a meeting every single day, it wasn't because there was something wrong with me or I wasn't committed to my recovery, right? Obviously, I was plenty committed to my recovery because here I am 21 years later, so.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it can be really harmful and not recognizing that, you know, everybody is different and how meetings affect people is different. Some people, it's like they don't know what to do with themselves. They can't, you know, they feel like antsy if they're at home. They're afraid that they're going to be.
Yeah, by all means.
Then, yeah, if it works for you, awesome. But you know, we also have to account for, like, what's going on with us physically. If you're somebody who has health issues, or if you're somebody who is, you know, is working or does have a, you know, job that's demanding.
Or if you're triggered by meetings. Or you know, I was triggered, and I'm an empath, and I had health issues, and I had a disordered relationship with food, and I had no idea how to comfort myself. That wasn't the right thing for me.
So I saw, what did I see? I don't remember where it was. If I find it, I'll put it in the show notes. But it was 30 days of self-care. And so, like, a meeting would count. It was a recovery thing. A meeting would count, but also, like, meditation would count. Or, you know, taking a nice selfie even is on there. Or
curling up on the sofa with a blanket and a book.
Yeah.
Like, that's my favorite thing to do right now.
I loved that because it was kind of this concept of that, you know, all of these things contribute to our recovery and all of these things contribute to our mental health and, you know, doing the thing, making sure that you're taking those actions, that you're showing your willingness, right? Because we do have to strive for recovery, especially at first. It takes effort. But what is actually self-care is different for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So what are the closing things you would like to say?
I just want to say that in this debate, I would consider, you know, first consider your language and consider, you know, the impact that you're having on yourself and on other people, but also in the messages that we receive, consider where these messages are coming from. So if it's, you know, if it is a, you know, a fitness blogger's post and they're saying, like, you're
no excuse.
Yeah, no excuses, right? Then, I mean, they're profiting off of that, right? And if you're in, you know, full disclosure, I'm a coach. I'm an intuitive eating coach. And, you know, I do make my money by coaching people in intuitive eating. However, I also have, there's a lot of free resources. If someone, you know, can't afford to work with me, I'm not going to say, well, you know, too bad. I'll send them resources. I'll have a conversation with them. So, you know, consider where it's coming from and consider the biases of that person or those people. And, you know, if it's coming from Weight Watchers. So, you know, there's a leader that I really love, and most of what she does I think is amazing, but it's Oprah, and she has stock share in Weight Watchers. So, you know, Weight Watchers profits off of us believing that
we need to be smaller.
We need to be smaller, that we, you know, we can't control ourselves around food, all of these things. And, you know, that message of being a sugar addict may not be coming directly from her, but, you know, she and Weight Watchers is profiting off of us buying into all of the diet culture messaging. Yeah. So, you know, just consider that. Even if it's a celebrity, you know, they're likely profiting off of it. Even if it's not their company, a lot of times they have affiliate links, right? So when they do a cleanse and then they promote the cleanse, they definitely make money off of that. And even if they didn't, they're not your doctor. And, you know, they're not, they don't have a science background. Like, they're not necessarily doing something that's even healthy for them, let alone something that's healthy for you. So, you know, just consider these things when you are taking in these messages. All right. Well, thank you so much. Today was so much fun, and we can't wait to talk with you next time. Thank you for listening to Breaking Free Podcast, Your Recovery, Your Way.
We want to hear from you.
Email us at hello@breakingfreerecovery.com or join our Facebook group, Breaking Free Community.
Tell us what Breaking Free means to you.